It's all in your head. You need to unwind. You're losing your grip. The paranoia never ends. It's all in your head. What you see in your mind. There's no reason to trip. The paranoia never ends.
Sometimes I stare at the wall when I'm alone in my room. I'm an abusive reclusive like Dr. Doom. Parts of darkness descend and consume me. You won't believe the gloomy thoughts that run through me. I'm full of appointments, but if you spend the night, you leave the next day like I don't think his head's on right. Try to talk to myself, but I don't listen. I got split personalities and competition. But which one's a man that I got issues? I could be standing in front of your face and I'm not with you. Schizophrenia, shame, brain distorted. Sort of compulsive, obsessive disorder. Mathematical pattern addict with a cleft mind. Before I go to bed, I hit the light switch 7 times. Yeah, so I'm never mind. Put the night back. Match out, I'm out of my mind, but I'll be right back.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to episode 3 of the Paranoid Gamer podcast. I'm your host, Robert. With me is Taylor.
Hey.
And Daniel.
Hello.
Fresh new perspective to the podcast this week. So I think what we're going to do, that's the idea, is to cover used games for the first section of the podcast. What are you guys' thoughts on that?
I'll let Daniel go first.
Thanks,
I want to move in, I want to move into attack position just in case.
No, I think for a change, I think me and Taylor pretty much agree that, you know, if the stuff with Durango and PS4, whatever they're going to, Orbis, whatever they're going to call it, if they really do block used games content, I think they're massively shooting themselves in their own foot. And I really don't see it going forward like that either. But
I mean, what do you guys think is driving this urge? Like, I mean, these are hardware, you know, manufacturers. Why are they going this direction? You know, I mean, they Sony and Microsoft don't really usually directly publish all that many games. Why are they going in this direction, you think? Do you think it's
control,
pressure from the publishers, or
control, greed, money? Like, it's a whole,
but what I'm
stuff.
Saying is, do you think that they're taking the initiative, or do you think that publishers are kind of you know, trying to push them into it?
No, I absolutely think there's pressure from developers, because obviously they want a bigger piece of the pie. Like, you know, when they used to sell games, PS1 or earlier, they would see a lot of tail sales from those, where, you know, a game's still selling 6 or 7 months later, where they may still see those, but I think it's decreased. So they just want a bigger piece of the pie again. They're all just getting greedy, really. But I think that there's got to be some pressure from the publishers and developers. You know, I don't think it's all just Sony and Microsoft.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with that. I mean, I'm sure EA is putting their foot down on the throats of Sony and Microsoft, and probably Nintendo now.
And for anyone who doesn't, like, know, I mean, of this story, because we're kind of just assuming that they've already read up on all this. Just recently, there's been a lot of leaked information going on around the next generation of the Xbox, the next generation of the PS3, or rather, I should just say the PlayStation brand. And there's been a lot of word going around that these systems are going to not allow any sort of used games without having to pay for some sort of pass. So pretty much when you buy a new game, it's going to be tied to your specific online account and only to that account. When, if you ever decide to take it back and someone else buys that game, the only way that they can play it is if they purchase pretty much like some sort of license online to be able to play that game. Not just an online pass like people are very familiar with nowadays, but literally a pass to play the game at all. I mean, hell, it might even be that you buy the game and you get like a demo time to play for like an hour, and then you have to buy some sort of pass to continue playing.
Yeah, I mean, really, who knows how that's going to work? Yeah. Well, you don't think that they're going to do that? You don't think they're going to go through with that?
I can't ever see that actually going through. I just don't see that people would actually support that. I think the online passes is pretty much as brave as they really can get without getting their asses handed to them by consumers. I mean, because they've kind of introduced it this generation anyway, so the foundation's already laid, basically. I think that if they tried to do something as drastic what Taylor is saying, that I think they would get crucified for it, really.
Well, history, though, has shown us that a lot of times these corporations will push the line until they get pushed back. And so I don't necessarily know that they're going to stop until people make them stop, to be perfectly honest.
That's going to be the big problem, is because I think gamers are willing to eat a lot of stuff. So I don't know. If people actually vote with their wallet, we can stop it. But we've seen with DLC and stuff that they just don't. That is
or things like the Steam groups where they're boycotting a game, and then you check out the day after release, you check the Steam group and you see that 90% of them are playing the game.
Exactly.
Jeez.
So we I don't think we're a very high willpowered group, really. I think we gripe and holler because we really want to have it our way, but I think a lot of people, when it comes down to it, are very vocal about it, and then when the DLC or the game comes out, then they rush out to the store and grab it.
Well, the gaming hobby itself is a very latest and greatest focused hobby. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
And so, you know, when someone's willpower is measured up against, you know, their friend saying, "Oh man, I just got this. It's so amazing. You should get it." And they're like, "Well, you know, online passes." And their friends, you know, like, but, you know, come play with me. It's so awesome. And they're like, you know, okay.
And I've got a friend like that who just doesn't care. He doesn't care about online passes. He's like, "Well, I just don't see how it affects me."
And even I've even told Robert before, I'm like, you know, I don't go to other people's houses and play and things like that. So online passes really don't usually affect me. So to me, it's a non-issue, though I can see where it is an issue. It's not an issue for me. So I can see a lot of people being like that where, "Oh, this is wrong, but I'm still going to buy the game because I don't care," you know, individually.
I mean, online passes don't affect me all that much either because I have a decent amount of disposable income. But at the same time, I really hate to use this phrase, this whole idea, but it really is the principle of the thing. I should not have to buy back a portion of the disc that I own. I shouldn't have to buy part of the experience that's encoded on that disc. I mean, it's just ridiculous, quite frankly. And the same goes for Day One DLC and sequester content. There's really just no reason for it. It's just ridiculous that you don't own what you bought.
So what do you guys see as a way around this? So the online passes and things are not the best option, but obviously what Taylor was talking about is even worse. So what do you two come up with that as our, you know, as our fixed a situation? How can we reach a middle ground?
Like a way that the publishers can do something to encourage people to buy new without pretty much screwing the consumer over that like everybody comes out happy?
Exactly.
Well, I have one example that I've told Rob a few times. Example that I have is Prototype 2 is coming out this April, and all new copies of the game, no matter where you get it from, come with something called the Radnet Edition, a code to download this content package online. And what it is it doesn't have anything to do with the story. You're not missing out on any story content or anything like that. And what you do is a couple times a week, you get pretty much challenges. Destroy this many things in this amount of time, you know, races, things like that. Completely outside the story, and, you know, they don't even really make sense in it because why would he go flying around racing helicopters? But and what you get in return is you get things like not unique powers, but small perks, little additions to your abilities. You get things like exclusive behind-the-scenes content, like motion capture footage, concept art, things like that. And this steady stream of content continues for several months in a single-player game, offering a fresh challenge to people, you know, along the line. And at the very end of it, once you complete all of it, you get a skin of Alex Mercer, so that you can pretty much play the game as play the entire second game through as the original protagonist. And this is not sequestered single player content. you know, and this isn't taking anything away from someone who does buy it used for the most part. They're not like taking out a chunk of the game and selling it back to you. These are just side missions, pretty much, like completely unrelated, with some cool little goodies in it. And everyone who buys a copy of the game gets it. And I think that's a good solution.
What has the reception to that been so far?
Honestly, it doesn't seem like that many people have really picked up on it in the gaming media. Like, I mean, they just look at it as like, you know, cool. They don't. I don't think it's really been examined in like the overall, you know, how this compares to other sorts of downloadable content. Where they, you know, in a lot of games, like this kind of stuff is buy it new and get some nifty weapons, or you know, get a Catwoman. Like, I think like Arkham City is a fantastic game, but sequestering the Catwoman thing, like literally taking a massive chunk out of the game if you don't buy it new and then buy it online, is a little too far. I think maybe something more like tons of Batman challenge missions and stuff like that and side content would have been a better addition, so that you're not taking anything from the main game. But, you know, that's how I see it, is that any sort of additional content to entice the consumer to buy new shouldn't be taking away from the narrative of the game and from the core content.
Well, I think another really good example is Reckonings, or Kings of Amalur, the House of Valor side mission, how they just kind of added that as a piece of content for new buyers. It's not an online pass. I mean, it's kind of locking content, but at the same time, it's not completely necessary for the game. So I don't necessarily mind that, but I think online passes are bad news. I think they're bad news for developers. I think they're bad news for consumers. They're never going to – if anything, it restricts people from really making really good multiplayer games, I think.
Well, then, and to be perfectly honest, like and this is almost – this is almost a verifiable fact, but you know, you can argue if you want to that companies like EA have made it policy to force multiplayer into single player focused games simply to charge for that online pass. A primary example being Dead Space 2 and Mass Effect 3. Now, whether or not those multiplayer experiences were good or not, or you know, or valid or not, is moot to the point that those were mainly added in to justify an online pass.
I think, and I had read where they had planned the Mass Effect 3 long ago, but then again, we don't know if, obviously it may have been driven out of that anyway, but they had been talking about trying to add multiplayer anyway. And like you said, we're not talking about whether it was good or not, because I personally think that I've not experienced Dead Space 2 multiplayer, but I know that the Mass Effect 3 is probably one of the best examples of horde mode I've seen, but you know, it'd be interesting to find out if that actually was.
I believe if you search for some articles, and this could just be a fabrication of my mind, so like a little disclaimer there, like, but I believe that I read some articles where EA was somewhat openly talking about how it was their policy at this point to attempt to make more of these single-player games have a multiplayer portion, so that they could do online passes and extend the lifespan of single-player games, of traditionally single-player franchises. If you look around, you may be able to find those articles.
Yeah, didn't they call it like Project $10 or something like that?
Yes. That's what I was thinking of. Yes.
So Project yeah, $10. I mean, I wouldn't doubt it. I'm not gonna put it past them. But I mean, like in the example of like Mass Effect 3, I definitely don't think that it hurt the game in any way. In fact, I think it added something to it. So I think gamers won out there anyway. And while I understand, like, you know, paying the $10 may be frustrating, if you're planning to buy the game new anyway, I mean, whether it's locked or not, it's kind of just one of those things.
But then you're getting right back into what we were talking about. It's like online passes aren't, no matter what how you look at it, they're sequestering a portion of the game away for $10. It's on the disc. It's right there, and it's taken away from you.
Yeah, I mean you can't really, like, I guess my point is you can't really dislike or be for locking content, but not be for online passes or certain types of DLC. They're all like extensions off of each other. They're all tests to see how far they can push the consumer.
I honestly think that they're going to keep pushing until they get pushed back.
Because Chad, why not? I don't see happening anytime soon, honestly.
Yeah,
me neither.
No.
You don't think the consumers are pushing back?
Because like I said, we're still seeing billions of sales no matter what. I mean, people will complain about it because they don't like it. But in other words, if Ubisoft said tomorrow, hey, we're doing an online pass portion where you can't get out of multiplayer, which they've already done. They did that with the second one.
Revelations.
Yeah. But they did that with Revelations. So they say, well, we're going to do this, and we're also going to lock these two to pre-order things like they've already done. People are still going to buy Assassin's Creed 3 no matter what, especially new, because they're going to say, well, I'm buying this day one anyway. We can argue about principle, and while we may agree it's wrong, they're still going to go buy it because we want to play Assassin's Creed 3 so bad. I mean, I don't know that there will be a point when they start, they get even worse, that I think the people eventually push back. But right now, I don't see it happening. There's a lot of complaining, but I don't see any actual conviction followed through here.
Do you see a point when that's going to happen?
I don't know. Once it reaches a point where, I really don't know, because you're already looking at cutting out a whole portion of a game like multiplayer. And selling it back to customers. So I don't know when it's going to reach a point, because I don't think it'll ever get to the ridiculous, you know, parody of where you're buying the jump animation or something. But maybe someday it will get to a point where, you know, you played half the game and then they're like, okay, so in order to play the rest of the game, give us, you know, $20 more or something. I mean, I don't know if
Super
that's
going to happen. Game, new Super Mario game where you have to spend $10 to get the Fire Flower unlocked.
Yeah, exactly. See, and once it hits that point, I could see it being like, well, screw this, I'm not buying this. And, you know, they're kind of pushing their luck anyway, because while you're never going to get the exact same experience as of right now on a Facebook game or a free-to-play game online, it's just there's too many options up right now. And so when it reaches a point where those experiences, and they're getting there now, are getting to the level where they're high quality and maybe could someday even replace their traditional experience, I think at that point when people will be like, well, I'll just go over here, forget you. Or well, like, I mean, if somebody swoops in like with the Steam box, or Robert was talking about like the On Live, you know, and once somebody gives them an option that's not doing this business, then they're going to jump ship.
To be perfectly honest, I already think that we're at a turning point right now. If you just look at some of the economic data, I mean, just stuff about Best Buy came out today. They had record numbers of losses in their video game division. So people are already starting to vote with their wallet. You know, whether that has to do with tough economic times or you know, online passes and that type of business practices, you know, that's totally debatable. But, you know, people are starting to vote wallet in some way or another. You know,
what's interesting. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. But a thing, too, though, is if a game has a well-crafted multiplayer experience that's going to have people playing it for months and months afterward and raving about it to their friends and stuff, and that experience is then backed up down the line with things like new game modes, map packs, or even expansions in the case of like Battlefield 3. When that multiplayer experience is backed up that way, even when someone buys a used copy, usually to play with friends because their friends have been talking about it, they get online and they're enjoying that experience a month down the road, you know, when this DLC comes out, the developer will make profit off that DLC when people start to buy it, even people with used copies. I mean, there is still a revenue stream for the developers for multiplayer with used games.
Yeah, I think they're being very singular in their approach to addressing this. You know, they're not looking at all the options. I mean, there's almost an unlimited wealth of options here in order to combat used sales without you know, stripping retailers out or screwing the
and
consumer
anyone
over.
Who thinks that used games are killing the industry is that is complete marky. The 90s, you know, during which we saw just the complete rise in prominence of video game stores as being like a major means of just, you know, acquiring instead of just going to your local department store and picking up games like you would used to in the 70s and the 80s. You know, as these stores came up, the video game industry grew up alongside these stores. They rose from a child's plaything in the eyes of most people to become what I believe is like the highest grossing entertainment medium in the world. And if the used game industry was killing video games, how in the hell did it go from the point that it did to becoming such a dominant entertainment medium with the giant tick of used games sucking away at it this entire time? It has done virtually nothing to impede its growth. Mm-hmm. And, yeah. And the fact that you can't sell, you know, that you don't own a hard product that you've bought and that you can't take it into a store, resell it, pawn it, do whatever the hell you want with it. Because they're implementing all these sorts of restrictions on this content that technically, you know, that you own once you buy that disc is just complete malarkey and a complete, you know, slap in the face to consumer rights. And they're going to keep pushing it as far as they can go to attempt to help their bottom line.
Yeah, it's something that almost leaves you speechless, you know, as someone who's kind of just watched everything grow to the way it is now, it's almost kind of sad in a way, you know? I mean, I remember, you know, in the 90s, you know, playing, you know, like Fallout and stuff, and these huge, rich experiences, and then in the PS2 era, and it's like, you know, it was just to think that it could get better than this, and then we get into this generation and everything's great, you know, I mean, we're getting some quality titles and new IPs and stuff. And then for the last two and a half years, we're starting to get these kind of really ridiculous business practices that are just really hurting consumers.
I mean, I think part of it's due to the prevalence of internet connections becoming, you know, good broadband internet connections becoming more widespread. That is actually kind of led to this huge decline, which I think is very sad. And it's because of that widespread use of internet, you know, of broadband availability, that they can start implementing, you know, strategies such as online passes, that they can release buggy, abominably glitchy games and then just rely on patches later to fix them. When in the past, you either released your game, you know, good to go, or, well, on console anyways, or it was forever going to be a buggy, horrible game that people were going to avoid. And, you know, now with the prevalence of online features and readily available broadband for a relatively cheap amount of money, they've been able to fall back on all these strategies and all this pretty much half-assed way of creating and doing business.
I just look at Fallout, Fallout 3. Yeah, that's an example of Skyrim.
Yeah, with Skyrim, it's fairly well documented that they knew they had severe memory leak issues on the PS3, and they just released it anyways, hoping they could patch it later.
Yeah, and there's so many examples. I mean, it was almost tiring to list them all.
It used to be that if you released a game in that kind of bad state, that there was nothing you could do about it, and bad word of mouth would kill it. Now they can just push it out, and when you go, when you buy a launch title, you know, when you buy a title the day it comes out, and you get online and there's all these problems and all these bugs and things like that, and you're talking on mics to people, what does everyone say? Don't worry, they'll patch it. And that's become the mindset. Like, you know, people aren't even as angry.
Now.
Yeah, it's in the culture. It's like, you should be more angry that they release it, not just hope that in their benevolency, they release a patch 2 months down the road.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of this, Daniel?
About patches in general?
Yeah.
I think it's getting out of hand. So you've got products that everybody seems to like Skyrim, that if they weren't be able to patch, there's a fantastic game in there that, and a lot of it they said is basically, yeah, a lot of people are gonna be like, well, they never tested this or shit, but with a game that big with a billion different permutations and things like that, they could have tested it from now till the end of time and released it and still had problems, still wanted to patch it. So I think there is a middle ground there. Like, I'm glad that there's patches so that they can fix problems that maybe they didn't see, because you know there's a little bit of difference between hundreds of people having their hands on it and millions. But I think they are getting into the point where their mindset is, let's just release it and then see what happens.
Oh, I mean, I totally agree that there are unforeseeable, or virtually so, problems that can only really come out when you release your game into the landscape and people start, you know, flooding your forums with bug reports of all these random things that just, you know, that you never really saw coming. But in Skyrim's case, we're not talking about, like, you take one dialogue option out of 10 and it puts you in an infinite loop and you can't complete a quest or something. It's like a bug. We're talking about massive systemic memory leak issues with the code of the game and the way it runs on an entire system, preventing people from getting more than, you know, 50 hours into what's supposed to be a massive long experience in the first place. To the point, like, I was freezing and on a brand new slim PS3, by the way, I was freezing every hour consistently over and over and over again and having horrible frame rate issues. Like, yes, they did for the most part fix that months later, but they released it in that state knowing it was like that. And there's a difference between small quest issues and a massive systemic issue with your game that you knowingly push out there and just hope for the best.
Yeah, those are obviously problematic, but I don't really think it's anything new, especially if you follow any of the testing stuff out there now. A lot of times games are shipped, and this is all as far back as like the PS1, you know, so it's not anything like earth shaking, but even back then they just, especially on the PC, they would throw out games. So, and I think PC gamers have been dealing with it for a lot longer than we have.
Yeah, but a thing with PC unlike console is that the community can sometimes patch it themselves. They can be proactive, while on console you have to be completely reactive and wait.
So they can basically mod it and fix it themselves without having to wait for the...
Yeah, for exactly. The actual developer.
Mm-hmm. I do want to kind of go back a little bit, because I do want to wrap this up. What would happen, like, how would you guys view, say that the Durango and the Orbis or the PS4 and the Xbox 720 or whatever they're going to be called, what if they came out with those restrictions? How would you feel about that? What would you do? And what do you think people should do?
Well, the funny thing to me is that the Orbis seems like it has some really interesting, amazing features, like the fact that I could go buy a game, come home, completely, like 100% install it on my system and never have to change discs again, that once I lock it to my online account, that I can then from that point on download it from PSN at any time. And those are wonderful ideas, but the fact that I can't take the disc over to a friend's house, so, like, under any circumstances really and play it, or that I can't rent games, that would almost kill Gamefly, for instance, by the way, that you can't buy any games used without having to pay pretty much a licensing fee to play your game. I mean, I don't even know. I guess it would honestly, you know, with the latest and greatest mindset, that's a big part of this culture. I mean, I honestly guess it would depend on what they give you to make up for that. I mean, would it be worth... They'd have to give you something pretty good to be worth pretty much signing over your consumer soul for, in my opinion.
What do you think, Daniel?
Personally, I would go Wii U if Nintendo's going to go a different direction and allow used games, and they're going to have full backwards compatibility with the Wii, and they're going to have titles that are on par with the current generation. Because honestly, graphics and stuff, I'm happy with where they're at now. I don't necessarily think we need like this huge jump. So I think that for me, I would basically go with the competition for a lot of my games. I'd probably still get like a 360 or a PS Orbis or Durango or whatever they're going to call them, and use it to supplement my gaming. But I may switch over as a main gamer to Wii U if they're going to offer better, you know, I'm going to be able to go out and buy a game used on the Wii U and bring it home, then maybe a greater portion of my time is going to be spent there as a hardcore gamer as opposed to on one of the big two systems. But I'm like, Taylor is also in the fact that it really just depends on, because we know so little right now that it really just depends on what comes down the pike.
And plus, though, too, it's just another, you know, directly related to this. Another good option for any gamers out there who, you know, down the line you see yourself like, you know, you can't support this. Things like on Live, and even honestly just investing in a good gaming PC and you know, using Steam and good old games and good sites like that to game instead might just be the thing. Just abandon the platform entirely if you have to. You'll find that once you make the initial investment in PC, that generally a lot of games you download on PC tend to be a lot cheaper and you get a lot better deals than what they try to shove down your throats on consoles anyways. So, I mean, if you have to, just do what you have to do to feel comfortable with your purchases and who you're giving your money to.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that on Live, provided they're still around, they could see a huge explosion, really. If theoretically say that they did, that's what they did, that's how they handled their business, I think that on Live would be probably a huge competitor. And I'm sure they're licking their chops, hoping that that happens. That's what I would do. If I ran on Live, I would be hoping and praying that Sony and Microsoft would do that, because then you could compete with them directly. Because right now the issue with on Live is it's trying to put tech out there that's really not widely accepted yet. So it's kind of it's swimming against the current, so to speak. Whereas if Microsoft or Sony or Nintendo or any of them did something like that, they'd be able to really take advantage of that.
Well, plus, I mean, too, does online even need, you know, upgrading to keep up with another generation, you know, a generational leap? I mean, because it's just streaming off of computers to your TV pretty much for the most part. Am I right?
Yeah, I mean, it takes the games. The games are essentially, you know, programmed for on Live, and it streams them.
So, I mean, you wouldn't even need to buy a PS4, really, or an Orbis or whatever to get that generational leap.
You could play them through. You could play them through your PC for any PC related games, and that's the app itself is free. All you have to do is pay for the games, and if you want the console, it's $100, but you get the console, a controller, an HDMI cable, an Ethernet cord, you know, battery pack. You know, it's well worth the $100, and you're not putting a $400, $500 investment into a console. So
there are options out there if you find yourself unable to give your money to someone based on your righteous gamer rage. So so just look into your options and see what you might be most comfortable with to anyone out there listening.
I think a large subset that we left out that are would really get dicked over by these new moves are the people that – I have several friends that don't have broadband or limited in how much they can download. So things like the patches and the DLC and all this crap that they've got right now really hurt them. So –
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's something I was complaining about is before a couple of days ago with Skyrim. That is a single player focused game. It really has no online features. And, you know, for the people, what about people out there like you're describing, some of your friends or even people out there in rural areas who simply cannot get access to high speed internet and they've bought an irreparably broken game? What do they do?
That's the big question. That's what's going to happen is, I mean, and maybe we'll see GameStop turn into this download center where you can go, and actually you already see it, where you can go buy the content and from them. And
Impulse,
go,
yeah.
Yeah, and go put it on your console at home or, you know, there. I don't know what's going to happen, but I know that it's just another way to take away consumers' rights. And I think that, you know, they're just going to find other consoles like we've talked about.
Yeah. So any closing comments on the used game stuff, guys?
It would be as good as them shooting themselves in the face if they did that, in my opinion.
Nintendo and OnLive are just waiting, Sony and Microsoft. Nintendo and them are like, do it!
And it's a very, very, very quick aside. Nintendo's actually had a really good record in not feeding into all of this, you know, DLC, online pass, kind of garbage that a lot of the other consoles and stuff have been feeding into lately.
They have Look how that's working out for them.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, and obviously they're making money. So, so obviously they're making money. So it's not even a theoretical thing. It's right there in front of people's faces. I mean, it still works And I was telling them that that's part of a refreshing thing is be able to come home and put a game in my system, not download 15 things and have a complete game, you know? So I guess we'll see, really.
There's nothing to do but to wait and watch and see what's coming up. What's coming up.
It's going to be an interesting E3 this year and next year as well.
Oh, man, I'm looking forward to Hell Week.
That's really what it is.
Yep. I'm looking forward to Hell Week.
Yeah, no sleep, you know, at all. Ugh.
Cannot wait.
Anyways, so I think what we wanted to do is kind of adjust and talk a little bit about the paranormal side. Daniel himself, you know, has had an experience, you know, a paranormal experience. You know, he actually has an article, What Are Ghosts, that kind of talks about, you know, the different types of paranormal activity, because, you know, it's not always, you know, Casper the ghost.
and we'll be sure to link that article beneath the podcast as well.
Exactly. And I just wanted to, you know, have him talk a little bit about his experiences. And if you just want to discuss the discuss your experiences a little bit, that'd be great.
Okay. So I guess it's kind of there's multiple ones. And I talk about them more in depth on the My Personal Experience with the Supernatural. We can link that also. But basically, I've had several experiences throughout my life that have made me question, I don't know, whether or not we're alone. And like I was saying, I don't, I say in the article too, I'm not a person that, I'm not one of these crazy people wearing tin hats, you know, that is scared to go to bed at night, or when I shop for my house, I try to check for ghosts or anything like that. So it's not like a stereotypical person that you would think of when you think of, you know, some hillbilly guy out there that's making it up for attention.
Don't knock tinfoil hats, man. They're pretty snug.
Yeah, I hear the Paranoid Gamer, they're standard.
Yeah, we sell those in our shop for 99 cents a piece. No.
Hershey Kisses heads.
So, I mean, you both have read my article, correct?
Yep.
Yes.
So, I mean, I guess we can open it up for a question as far as if you have any specific questions on the events, or do you want me to go over them here?
I think you should briefly go over the events, maybe an abridged version of them.
I think we should go event by event, just real quick in sort of a general outline, and then we'll throw a few questions around and just talk about it.
Okay. I mean, some of the stuff is really simple stuff, and I don't really cover it very much, just, you know, seeing things out of the corner of your eye and things like that, I don't really cover. One of the things I talk about is, you know, I used to have this dog named Gigi, and people may laugh and stuff, but she was literally there since the day I was born, up until I was 14, 15 years old. You know, went with us all over the country because my dad was in the military. So when she died of cancer, we were absolutely distraught. And I'd actually seen her after that. And I don't know, I'd only seen her once after that. And it wasn't like, you know, some ghost dog running across the yard. It looked like a real live dog running across the yard. And you know, I had told my parent about it, my mother, and she had actually had a weird look at the time, and come to find out later that she had seen the same thing not too long after. So I don't know if that was inspired by a heavy amount of sadness. You know, obviously there are scientific things that go on in the brain that we still don't even know about, but that was one of the things I covered in the article.
And I've always been I always lean towards the skeptical side with the desire. Like, I'm very skeptical, and yet at the same time, like, I'm one of those people that think, like, man, it'd be so cool if this stuff was actually out there, you know, if there was something more to learn about the universe and the way things work. But if you wouldn't mind me, like, I have a couple questions about it. Like, what breed was your dog?
She was a Sheltie. And there's actually, I don't have a picture of her because I was trying to find one to upload. My mom has a large variety of them. So I posted the thing. I just found a picture that looks very much like her. So she was a black and white Sheltie with a brown nose.
And was she the only one in the neighborhood as far as you knew?
Yeah, I mean, there's in our house, there's these huge fences, and surely they could dig under them. But what I saw actually went through a fence, and so the dog ran through a fence, basically.
And were there, like, any...
We have a backyard and a front yard, and a fence separates the middle of the backyard, because we used to have horses back there.
Mm-hmm.
So
she actually
across and through.
Did she have any identifying... Like a collar, like something that's just almost unmistakable, or?
Yeah, I mean, she had a collar, but other than that, nothing you could identify from that far back. So, because I was at the top of the hill and she was near the bottom. So there's a hill. Our back of our yard is almost, it's like 3/4 acre. So, you know, I was at the top of the hill and she was at the near the bottom when she started across the yard.
And so the odds of it being just some random stray dog, going through a fence is pretty small then.
Yeah, I know this for a fact. I know it wasn't a real dog. If it was anything, like I said, it may have been some kind of weird hallucination brought on by grief. But I know that it couldn't have been a real dog because it literally started like halfway through the yard and was gone at the end of the yard. So it was like literally. Either A, it was an hallucination of a grief-stricken mind, or B, it was, I don't know if it's a spirit or whatnot. And that's another thing is that I'm actually, believe it or not, I'm very skeptical of a lot of stuff too. I'm extremely down to earth. I mean, if I win a prize on the radio, I'm like, yeah, right. You know, so for me to make that leap and be like, I believe what I saw, but maybe 100 years from now, they'll come up with an explanation as to what it actually was. But as of right now, we can only go off what we know. So,
and did your mother, didn't she like initially deny that she saw anything? And then she didn't deny anything.
She just kind of patted me on the shoulder and, you know, cause I'm still like 13, 14. I don't remember my exact age, but you know, I'm still very much a child more than I am, you know, an adult. So at that point, she's kind of trying to protect me and she didn't want to admit that maybe that she had seen the same thing. And, I think that's a big thing. And I actually have done that with my son.
Which actually is another one of those stories. So I guess we should probably just go in order from story to story.
Okay.
What was the next one?
I think the next thing I talk about in the article is where basically I had this Uncle Larry, and he had died not too long, a couple of weeks before the 4th of July, which he was a soldier and very much into the entire culture of that. After he was out, you know, and he still kept in touch. Well, I was already ready. So 4th of July was really big for him. He died shortly before that, so a couple of weeks after that. We were in our house, and like I said, we have about 3/4 acre in the back and about 1/4 acre in the front. I think I define it as a half acre in the article, but either way, it's where we're out in the country. It's very hard. It would be very hard for somebody to come up to our house and knock on the door or run away. And what we saw was somebody walking across the porch, because you have to walk across it to get to the door. And knocking, and there was no like nobody was like it's the middle of the day, and all my brothers are home, my mom's home, you know, all the dogs and stuff are home, and everybody reacted like you normally would when somebody's coming to knock on the door. So it wasn't anything where like anybody's like, oh, I just saw a ghost walk across the porch. It was somebody's there and opening there was nobody. There's even a little window on the door, and there was nobody there. You know, we look, and it would be literally impossible for anybody but like the Flash to knock on the door and get away in such a way that this happened. This actually happened 3 separate times. So this year, 2 4th of Julys, close to the 4th of Julys, wasn't always like a day of the 4th of July or the 3 days four, something like that. It varied, but it happened twice more that I was at the house, and it's never happened since that I know of, but I was there for both the occasions.
So, barring a visit from Shoeless Joe Jackson knocking on your door, I mean,
Yeah, so I just don't. There's no way somebody could have knocked and got away. So, and it was a very succinct sound, like somebody knocking. So I don't. And we have a hood. We have an overhang over the porch, like the roof covers the porch. So it wasn't even anything like a, you know, weather, which it was a really sunny day outside. Nothing hitting the door that I knew of, but.
And you said, like, you caught glimpses of the figure, and they were dressed in clothing that, like, seemed attributable to your uncle.
Yeah, just a plain white shirt, which is he pretty much always wore, like jeans and a white shirt. So it was just kind of like you seen a torso or somebody, because when somebody walks by a window, it's not like you're not watching them in slow motion. It's kind of like flashes of their clothing and stuff, because our windows aren't very big. I mean, they're decent size, but they're not like huge pane windows. So you see a flash past two of the windows and then somebody knocking on the door. And it was very much like what he wore. But then again, like I said, who knows? That's just what we've labeled it at that point.
Did your family find this comforting or disconcerting for the most part?
I think my mother found it mostly comforting. I think she feels very much like it was her brother. I don't know how I felt about it. It never scared me. Like, it wasn't a scary thing.
Which is why I said disconcerting, as if, like, disquieting. Yeah,
it was a little disquieting. I mean, anytime you see something like that or that you can't explain, it causes questions and makes you ponder and obviously a little uncomfortable. Because if there's something like that out there, is there something more? Which actually kind of leads into the next thing, which...
Yeah, and I have some questions, like overarching questions about all this that I'm going to save till the end.
Okay,
that I would very much like
definitely.
To ask.
The Ouija board stuff, just really quick, because it's very in-depth in the article. But my ex-wife and I had played with a Ouija board, and back when we were engaged, and a lot of people think they're toys. And like I said, I'll point you out right now that there's something out there called the odometer effect, where psychological phenomenon, where basically you're unconsciously moving this and not realizing your body's moving this without your brain actually realizing that you're doing it. So there are those theories out there. And I've been at parties where it's completely fake and hokey. And all of my life before these incidents, I had played with those things as jokes and nothing ever happened. So I can totally see both sides of the fence there. But in this instance, we got something on the other side, or apparently we hate ourselves subconsciously. I don't know.
But, don't we all?
Yeah, exactly. And it was a very violent entity. It called itself Jim, basically. And there were, you know, trumped up things that it said that was you know, things that it said about things that maybe we subconsciously remembered, like names of towns we never heard of, that it supposedly died in of a plague and all that stuff. But we could never find specific. We did a lot of research, actually. I mean, like microfiche research and you know, going online and things like that to try to find out who this person was, if there was even a person like that, or what the case was. But, We consistently conferred with this individual person or thing, and the more we conferred with it, the easier it was to connect to. And again, that could also lead back into the odometer effect, because it could be that the more we accepted this fantasy, the more
you freak yourself out about it.
The easier it was to slip into it subconsciously. Yeah, exactly. So eventually it became, you know, it goes into a lot more depth in the article, but basically it became very violent, hateful. I myself started having night terrors. I was very a lot of people at that time in my life told me that I don't think I was possessed or anything, but a lack of sleep, a worry that this person was real. I became almost obsessed with this thing over these few weeks periods, and people said that, you know, I was unfun to be around. I was cursing. I was behaving like a complete asshat, basically. very, very affected by all this stuff. And eventually and basically something I go into is the first time we talked to it, we didn't say goodbye. Which if you read online, a lot of people that actually do believe in the Ouija board and believe in entities and things out there believe that that's like the worst thing you could possibly do. Like, is not
leaving this, a door
this,
open
this kind of thing. Yeah, is leaving, yeah, quote unquote, leaving door open. But you know, basically at the end we ended up burning this thing. And
did all such problems like attributed to that cease upon burning it? Or,
well, we also I was agnostic. She was very religious, and she brought a Bible into the situation and prayed over it and all this stuff, and used the same passage that preachers use to bless a home or to dismiss, you know, people from the area. So basically did that, and then we burnt it, and it was all very melodramatic, you know, because we're younger. I think I'm like 21 or 22 at this point, and it was all very melodramatic, but at the same time for us at the point we felt like we were dealing with something very evil. And so, you know, it seemed very like the end of the closing of that story, basically.
And I think it's great too that you also acknowledge the possible psychosomatic aspect of it, that it simply could just have been somehow your imagination running wild, because I think that it really only gets into weird territory when people are just unequivocally saying like there's no other possibility but this or that, and I very much like that you acknowledge those aspects of your experience.
I think that anybody that's serious with themselves has to. I mean, really, because we never know. I mean, 100 years ago, or, you know, centuries and centuries ago, the Greeks thought that, you know, the sun was pulled across the sky by a god. Now we know it's just the way things work. So are we going to come up with explanations for this in the future? Are they going to be able to prove that the Ouija board? Possibly. But until that happens, there's only a few ways we as human beings can attribute these experiences.
And I guess, like, I was going to save this as one of my questions near the end, but I feel like this is the perfect time to bring it up now that we've hit this this subject line. But are there times that you ever doubt yourself? Like when things are normal and, you know, the lights are on and it's been a long time, you know, between any kind of experiences and stuff, do you ever just look back and just doubt yourself and you're like, maybe it wasn't quite what I thought, you know? And
Especially with the Ouija board, yes. Especially with the Ouija board. I sometimes question what happened there, but the last thing I wrote about in the article is
which I found to be the most interesting too, by the way.
Yes, and because it's the most recent, I can speak to it with a very a lot of passion, which again maybe that's affecting because it's very close to me still as to what have happened. And I've sensed all this, not because of it or in turn of it. I've come to religion. Obviously, we're not talking about that, but it has to be said there to go the next step. But anyway, we had a son. We have a son. He's 6 years old now. Mm-hmm. We had been living in an apartment after he was born. And we lived there for 2 years or so. And our belongings were going at a substantial rate, so we had to get a bigger place. So we found a very affordable trailer in a trailer park. It's like where you can go take your trailer and pay for that portion of land, small little piece of land. And you know, some people leave and then they rent their trailers out for whatever the case may be. We moved into a 1,900 square foot, you know, 3-bedroom, 2-bath trailer. Up to this point, my son had no problem in his bedroom sleeping by himself. He had no problem playing in his bedroom by himself. After we moved in here, almost immediately, there was a very distinct departure from that, where he wouldn't sleep in his bed. He wouldn't, and a lot of this could be contributed to just the behavior of a 2-year-old, you know, getting scared, basically. My son never has really been that scared. Like zombie movies, ghost movies, nothing really scares me. He lives very much in reality. Even stuff like on Halloween, you know, when he's dressed up as Darth Vader and somebody says, "Did you come here in your spaceship?" He's like, "This is a Halloween costume. I'm not Darth Vader." You know, he's very He's very down to earth in that way, almost to a fault. So basically what ended up happening was he would come in our room and constantly try to get in our bed. And again, we're sane people, so we don't immediately go, well, he's coming to sleep with us. There must be a demon inside his bedroom somewhere. We were like angry. We're like, you know, we got to get some sleep. You're going to have to start sleeping in your bed. And we came up with, you know, sticker charts and prizes and different things. And he wanted those prizes. He didn't want to be in trouble. So he would literally start sleeping go to sleep on the couch or sleep in the hallway outside of our bedroom. Or most often he would lay down next to our bed so that we wouldn't know he was there. Instead of sleeping in his room, and he wouldn't play in his room by himself. And he was a very independent person. He wanted to do everything by himself because that's how they are at that age. So he started having night terrors at some point, and they were pretty bad. And he had some hearing problems, so he was hard to understand back then. And he would he would talk about some of the stuff in the broad daylight, talk about shadow people and the shadow person in this room, which as an adult, you know, makes your skin crawl, but you're like, yeah, it's nothing. There's no such thing as ghosts or monsters because, you know, he's six. So
I do have a quick question, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead.
When he said that, like, aside from, like, just that kind of that feeling of dread, did you kind of feel like, given your past experiences, that it might have been something to begin with, or did you just kind of dismiss it at first?
A lot of it was still dismissing it, because I don't think that anybody that's hooked to this reality goes into a house and immediately jumps on, oh, it must be something ghost-wise. It was scary, and that's the first time where I was like, well, maybe. But then again, could just be things in his nightmares that he was having a hard time differentiating, because night terrors are very realistic.
Mm-hmm. Maybe he got something scary on TV for a few minutes that kind of, you know, stuck with him, you know?
Exactly. So at that point, you're still kind of discarding it. But what kind of collaborated with it and ended up where it was that it was an overall feeling with everybody in the household. Even my wife and I did not like that portion of the house. You know, that's where my PC was in a room two rooms down from his, and often it was a very uncomfortable place to be. I would often hear, like, my wife walking down the hallway. I would hear heavy footsteps. And again, I attribute it to my wife because I'm a normal person, so I thought it was just her. I would look, and my wife is borderline narcoleptic, so she goes to sleep in her bedroom. She doesn't get up, and so it's on the other side of the house. Both bedrooms were opposite sides of the house. And I would often hear those kind of things, and I would be sitting in the living room where you have a clear view down the hallway and see things moving. And again, you know, those could be a billion different things with tricks your eyes play.
Pareidolia.
Yeah. So basically just that feeling of wrongness. And even my brother, who was a grown man at the time, had stayed over one night and left before the end of the night because it was so uncomfortable. He swore there was something going on down there, and he doesn't believe in that sort of stuff. So
you kind of almost him, like, when this kind of came to light, you and your wife almost kind of caught yourself realizing that there was something that you didn't like there. Like, it hadn't quite dawned on you until
exactly.
It started, like, just coming out.
Yeah, exactly. We knew something was wrong. It kind of came to a point for me one day when I came home, and the front door was wide open. So immediately, as a grown man, the first thing I think is, holy shit, there's someone in my house, right? So, you know, I go in by myself. I came home by myself. My wife and son were elsewhere, and I went in the house, and I don't have a gun or anything in the house, so I get a frying pan, right? like the knight in shining armor. And I even remember yelling down the hallway. I'm like, I'm calling the cops, asshole.
Not knight in, like, shining that armor. Knight in shining Teflon.
There you go. Knight in shining Teflon. with nonstick, just in case I had to brain somebody. I could still use it for, you know, teriyaki the next day. But, you know, I went down the hallway into his room. I heard shuffling down there. After I yelled, the sound stopped. So then I was sure I was sure I was getting ready to get shot or stabbed or something was going to happen, but nothing. Like, I went into the room ready to kill somebody or try, and there was nobody there. Nobody in the closet. Nobody. The window was locked. Everything was normal. You know, I closed the door. I was very shaken.
Nothing was missing anywhere?
No, nothing missing. So, at that point, I did not tell my wife about this because I was like, I thought even I would seem crazy to even her at this point saying that this happened, you know? So, you know, and it got to the point where I even confronted whatever it was. At one point, with all this kind of culminating, I was like, would you just leave me the hell alone? Would you leave my family alone? It's ridiculous. I'm sure I would look like a crazy person, but it gets to that point. You know, I was having night terrors at that point too. And I had one as vivid and real as what I did back when the Ouija board stuff was going on.
And if you don't mind, for everyone listening, like, what would you describe as a typical night terror in this aspect? Like,
night terrors are, I don't know how much of our audience actually has had one, but night terrors are much more realistic than a dream, than a nightmare. When you wake up from one, you still are terrified. You know, you're sweating, you're screaming. It's a terrible experience to go through. The dread and the terror that you feel, they don't go away when you wake up. And it takes a long time for you to realize that what had happened was a dream or a night terror. But and a lot of times you're not supposed to wake a person up who has a night terror, that you're supposed to let them sleep because they harm themselves. But and the night terror I had that night was, and I'll never forget it ever. Basically, I was in the kitchen in the dream getting something out to drink. And my son's room is all the way down the hallway to his room. And I saw a man standing there over his bed. It was like this black around him. And he was standing there. I'm getting chills when I was talking about this. But he was standing over the bed and screaming, that's my son, get away from him. And he turned as his mouth open and possibly wide and split the sides. And he laughed at me like with this hissing sound, and then he screamed and this real shrill thing, and I woke and I was screaming in the room and I was crying and I ran down the hall. No, I mean, I wasn't crying. I was manly, like
you let out a howl of rage.
Yes, it was a howl of rage at the indignity, and I ran down the hallway into my son's bedroom like I was going to save him, because I was still not all there. Like, I still thought this was real, and he wasn't there. And I flipped out. I thought this whole thing was real and I had not dreamed it. And I went back and he was actually sleeping on the floor by my bed, like he normally does when he's scared. And it was shortly after this experience, probably a month and a half, we were sitting there. It was broad daylight, cartoons on, as far away from a scary situation as you can get, right? And he was a little bit older, you know, he's 4 years old at this point. And I'm like, son, why are you so scared to sleep in your bed and stuff? And he goes, his simple answer, and he's watching the TV, becomes a zombie in front of the TV. And he just says, because the shadow person was back there. And I was like, oh, I'm the hell out of here. You know?
Time to move out and burn it down.
Yeah, time to move out and burn it down. So we had actually started to buy a house process anyway. There was even a part where we had, after I discussed some of the stuff with my wife, where she had similar experiences, that we were going to bring in a priest to bless the home. And we did not. We ended up selling the house and going out. And a lot of that was not wanting to send the alarm bells off out to the neighbors that we were, you know, knucking futs. But so we, you know... And there was even a time moving out where I have one last box of toys in my son's bedroom, like the last thing in the house, right? And I go in there by myself, and maybe it's just all the experiences, but at that point I'm a grown man, you know, I'm like 27 years old, and I'm in this bedroom, and I'm scared shitless to pick up this box of toys and leave this house in broad daylight. I felt like the very real sensation that something – not only wanted to hurt me, but hated me, absolutely hated me. And I grabbed it and like darted out of the house. I slowed down like as I exited, because I wanted to be like all you know.
I bet
happen.
You loved turning your back down that hallway on your way out too.
No, I did not. No, I did not. No, it was a bad experience all around. And And the crazy thing was, once we moved into the house, my son's, all his stuff just stopped. Like, literally, he would go to bed by himself. Go get in bed by himself and sleep there the whole night without coming to bother us at all. He would be in his room by himself. He didn't talk about the kind of stuff. The night terrors were gone. All of it stopped. Just went away quickly. So I don't think that I know from experience of having a child that they don't usually change that drastically that quickly. They go through phases, true, but don't, it's not one day they're terrified to sleep in their bed and the next they're okay with it. So it was really like a straight change over when we moved into the home.
Can I ask you a somewhat serious, somewhat like jokey question?
Yeah, go ahead.
Do you ever feel bad for the people who moved in after you?
I was just like, suckers. I don't know. I refuse to go back. I don't know who's living there or what their case may be or if it's even still standing.
Was it an older mobile home?
Yeah, it was an older mobile home. I don't know exactly how old. I probably could do the research and find out, but I literally left the whole situation alone. Was just happy that whatever it was no longer bothering me and my family.
And do you feel like there was a connection between the events?
I've actually had that question before, and I don't know. I really don't. Because there was no consistent feeling like that in between like the Ouija board stuff and at the house. So I don't know.
You had all the elements, the kid, your wife, the when you were at an apartment. So like, what would really be the big difference between a mobile home and that? I mean,
exactly. So I think that if it had been something following me, one situation, it's just talk completely theoretical here. Let's say it was some kind of demon following me. Then I think that it would have bothered us at the apartment there and at the trailer and then at the house too. I don't think it would have stopped at any point from happening. So I think it was singular. I don't think it was connected to anything else. Like, in other words, I think your question is basically, do you think it was the same entity through all this stuff or the same kind of thing occurring? I don't believe so.
You want to know something that's very funny about this right now? It's like, when I read the article, I found it very, very interesting and I just kind of took it for what it was. And I watch plenty of scary stuff. I watch plenty of, a lot of us watch, the Ghost Hunters type of shows, all sorts of random stuff like that. And honestly, none of it really ever affects me once I'm done, like, watching it or whatever. But so, like, surprisingly, just hearing you talking about some of this actually gave me really weird shivers at certain points. I don't know about Rob, but, like, it was very, very weird for me.
We had been talking about it yesterday, and I find it all very fascinating, you know? It's not often that you get someone who wants to talk about this and answer questions. I have a couple more questions. I'm sure do you, Taylor?
Oh yeah, I have a couple questions, and I also think that I should offer right here too is that, I mean, if you're comfortable with it, Dan, that anyone who's listens to this can probably ask a couple questions in the comments, and I'm sure you probably wouldn't mind answering some too.
Yeah, not at all.
But
yeah, go ahead, Taylor.
Pretty much, I just wanted. I mean, again, like. About doubting yourself. I mean, what do you, if you had to describe something, would you say, I mean, would you think, that the presence at the home was literally like some sort of demonic presence, or would you, a spirit, or just something you don't even know what it was, you just know what you felt?
That's a hard question to ask.
It's more like your personal opinion.
Not a hard question to ask, but a hard question to answer. I think that if I had to call it something, by what I've read and what I've heard and what I've gone through, I would think it was demonic. I was truly evil. I don't think it was, just a residual haunting or something like that. I think it was truly something malevolent. Now, one story that if you believe in God and the devil and angels and all that, then you almost have to accept the other side of it, that there is extremely great evil in this world, and perhaps that it's not always because of don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that everybody that does anything bad ever has been possessed by a demon, or that everything scary that goes on or creepy could be a demon. But if we had to assign it something, it's either that or I don't know. Maybe it's you know, maybe some people have decided that things like that are sometimes caused by magnetic fields making you feel these feelings of fear are affecting your sleep patterns. You know, that some people think that it's a shared hallucinatory thing that can go on in the environment. There may be a billion scientific reasons for it. Right now, there's no way to contribute it to what I can. That seems familiar. And to me, it sounds like something truly wanting to hurt my family in at least a mental or emotional capacity. I mean, there wasn't anything like a bed hovering, you know, or something so grandiose. I think a lot of those people come up with having a time just, attention grabbing stuff. But what I felt, I know I felt was really real anyway at the time. And remember that time, I was agnostic.
Oh, so you were still agnostic. It's like, do you think your experiences contributed to kind of your different outlook on, like, I don't want to make the whole podcast about, like, religion and stuff.
No, I understand.
But
yeah.
Do you feel like that contributed to a change? Because based on how you're talking, it seems like you changed religious kind of.
I did,
statuses.
Yeah. I recently, very recently, like October, basically brought God into my life and to improve upon who I am, basically. And I don't know. Surely that could probably be part of it. Is that I glimpsed that side, or maybe that scared a little bit. I think people seek solace, and you know, if there is truly something out there that wants to hurt you, it feels good to have somebody on your side, so to speak, or to have a source of comfort that you can go to, your faith, for instance. So maybe a little bit, maybe it's encouraged it a little bit. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I don't know, dude. I mean, your dad is Fagin. I mean, isn't that like a paranormal experience on its own?
He's actually had a couple of paranormal experiences himself when he was in Maine. And
he's extremely reluctant to speak of them.
Well, I can tell you one of them. I'm sure he'll share it on another podcast. But there was one instance where, and he worked on a nuclear base in Maine. He was in the Air Force, and
this isn't the one that he shared before, is it?
No, with the pentagram. How they tore up the pentagram and tried to capture a ghost, and then the whirlwind came up and dropped the pentagram on the hood of a vehicle.
Yep.
No, that's not it. This is a totally different one. They had this guy. The alarm sound. They had this guy jacked up, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's dressed weird. He's not dressed in military apparel, right? They've got these huge floodlights on him. They're guns everywhere because you know they don't want someone on a freaking nuclear base, right? And this guy pretty much tips his top hat, looks at everyone, and then just walks through a solid wall.
Wow!
Like he had an actual top hat, he had tipped it invisible, like kind of.
Yeah, like
know.
I asked him. He actually had a top hat.
And see, and this is exactly what I'm talking about. I'm very skeptical.
I'm skeptical about it too.
Extremely skeptical. I'm like the full body apparitions most of the time. At the same time, it fascinates me.
Better explanation is that the government had the entire base tripping on LSD as a second experiment.
Yeah, but that's always an interesting experience. I do kind of want to close up on just the podcast in general. I mean, we've been going like an hour and 20 minutes, so well above our thing.
I think
fantastic conversation. If anyone has any questions about, you know, Daniel's experience, or you know, maybe they want to make a comment about the used games, make sure you put a comment in the comment section so we can reply to that. If you guys like the podcast, please, 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 please rate it on iTunes. That helps us get a little bit more exposure. Share it with your friends. Do all that good stuff. We really appreciate you guys listening.